还有阅读 SCI 论文的习惯，只要有过 SCI 论文投稿的经历，一定啊会和他的杂志打交道。那我就隆重推出我们第一位演讲者，是Journal of Advanced Nursing 的主编Dr. Roger Watson。Professor Roger Watson is a nurse author and editor with an international reputation. He is a professor of nursing at the University of Hull, editor-in-chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, and holds visiting positions in Europe, Australia, and the Far East. He has served as a summer panel member of the 2008UK Research Assessment Exercise and the 2014 Research Excellence Framework, and is a serving member of the Hong Kong Research Grants Council and a member of the Global Advisory Panel on the Future of the Nursing. 其实我在2016年美国护理科学院大会上，其实见过 Watson 博士。我们今天中午的聊天呢，才把这样的记忆给链接起来。当时参加首都医科大学护理学院吴医院长的授衔典礼，那 Watson 博士本身自己就是美国护理科学院的院士，所以非常有幸在这个平台呢，其实已经提前和他见面了。那他今天给我们带来的 topic 是 Evidence-based practice in nursing.The
chance. Welcome. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Hu Yan, first of all, for the invitation. This is my fourth visit to China this year, but my first ever to Shanghai, apart from going through the airport. So it's a wonderful, opportunity, and also to see so many friends.I didn't realise how many people were in the room until I turned round. There are other sessions going on, you know, you don't all have to be here. You'll notice that this is the title I was asked to address. I'm glad it's on the slides. It's a bit different from the one that's in the programme. I don't know how that happened. The title in the programme says reviewing latest trends or something. I'm afraid it's not about latest trends.So, very glad to be here. That's my University of Hull. It isn't cold all the time. Sometimes it's quite warm, but it does snow occasionally. I don't think you get snow in Shanghai, do you? No, you don't get snow in Shanghai, right? Right. Now, I'll admit straight away, I'm not an evidence-based practice person. I'm not involved in this at all. As an academic, I do research, which I hope provides some evidence for practice, and some of my work has certainly been included in systematic reviews. And I'm also an editor. I see evidence-based practice as being something very specialised and quite different from what I do. And I think many people get confused about evidence-based practice and research. But I'm very much in favour of it, but it's not my area of work. And what I notice is there's no shortage of information on evidence-based practice. If you go on to, this is amazon.co.uk, I'm sure Amazon exists here as well, to look for books, there's just page after page of evidence-based practice books. I mean, it goes on. You know, I couldn't believe how many there were. There's a copious amount of books on it. So it's a huge area. I'm sure not all of these books can be very good. I'm sure some of them are a little bit suspect, you know. And if you go to, again, another page, but it goes on and on. And likewise, if you go to a search engine, we use Google Scholar. I don't think you can use Google Scholar here, but a similar search engine. Again, you'll find lots and lots of papers on evidence-based practice. So there's lots and lots of information out there. It's been around for a long time. But what I want to look at today is really different kinds of evidence. I'm not going to say anything that you probably don't know, and I'm going to look mention at least the difficulties of implementing evidence and really what it means and where it stands. And if I've got time at the end, I'm going to say a couple of things about my own journal and what we're looking for, and by the way of papers that would contribute to the evidence base. I have to say we publish very few papers about evidence-based practice, and it would be really nice to see more papers, especially about the evidence for evidence-based practice. I think that would be the next step. You know, but we really don't get very many. So, again, all the different things, you know, even within my time as a nurse, you know, things have changed and moved on a lot. All the things that we were sure about, well, bloodletting, I don't remember bloodletting for fevers, but, you know, grommets for glue ears, this used to be standard practice. My children have had grommets, little plastic tubes put in their ears for glue ears. It's completely, we don't do this anymore. Episiotomies regularly for childbirth, lignocaine for heart attack, egg white and oxygen and vigorous rubbing for pressure. So all this is gone. And I have to say, this is really testament to the evidence-based practice movement, because these things have gone, and we're quite clear that many of these things are completely wrong now. And things do change. You know, I think we've got to appreciate that the evidence we have today may well change. You know, about 15 or 20 years ago, that was the latest technology in mobile phones, and but now phones are even smaller, and I'm sure we can now talk into our iWatches. Everything changes. So I'm very aware that evidence-based practice is a moving target. Things change over the years. Right, so what I wanted to just briefly consider was the, you know, what counts as evidence for evidence-based practice. Excuse me. And I think that, frankly, I think that nursing has been, our profession has been ahead of the game here, as you'll see. I think that the medical profession is very stuck on the whole on randomised controlled trials, which are one form of evidence, and they're a very good form of evidence, but I want to look at other forms of evidence closely related, and why some of these forms of evidence might not be might be more appropriate in certain circumstances. You know, but basically what counts as evidence to me is anything that's the outcome of systematic inquiry, basically of rigorous research. The Chinese came up there as well. Thank you to my helper for translating these beautifully into Chinese. I didn't do that. Okay. I'm sure people can have this. I see people taking photographs. I'm sure you can have the slides afterwards if you want to. And of course, we're all very familiar. I don't have to tell people in this room about the evidence pyramid. But always we see, you know, randomised controlled trials are right at the, almost at the pinnacle. They used to be at the top, but now systematic reviews are right at the top of providing evidence, which is correct. I think that systematic reviews are one way of, or the only way of synthesizing evidence, but we can synthesize different kinds of evidence. And other forms of research seem to come lower down, and survey research and follow-up research, things like that, seem to figure nowhere on this at all, yet they do provide evidence. Oops, I'm pressing the wrong button. Oh yeah, here we go. And of course, we're all familiar from the outcome of meta-analysis, which is the sort of pinnacle of systematic reviewing, with the forest plots. My problem with forest plots, one, I'm not a meta-analysis, so I don't put these together, but I understand how to read them. Correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't every meta-analysis end up with the diamond on the middle? You know, meta-analysis really don't seem to show us very much. They show us basically that some things work and some things don't. And of course, this is the very thing that the general public and many of our colleagues, especially in nursing, who are not so aware of research and statistics particularly, don't really understand. People tend to work from the thing they know, but they don't realise that if you assimilate the evidence, sometimes it isn't quite so good, because it's essentially people do, oops, there's a slide missing here. Basically, I was going to show a slide which showed the phenomenon of regression towards the mean. You know, everything you do that works one day, even if it's got a fantastically good effect, say aspirin is very effective for reducing stroke, one day another massive trial comes along, that's the line of no effect, and it falls on this side. And this is how it goes. And that's just the way that. That's just the way that nature is. You know, things don't always look very clear. So systematic reviews, meta-analysis, as rigorous and as helpful as they are, when they accumulate large amounts of evidence, don't actually often show very much. So I sometimes wonder just exactly how helpful they are. So anyway, some people, and particularly, and I'm not denigrating the medical profession, but the medical profession do seem to be very stuck on clinical trials, and we do seem to be under the impression that we need to do clinical trials for absolutely everything. There's no other way of doing things. You know, even in this case, testing parachutes. You know, there are some things for which we don't need clinical trials. We don't need to test a parachute that way, because we know if you jump off the cliff without a parachute, you're almost 100% likely to kill yourself. If you jump off with a parachute, you're not 100% likely to survive because of regression towards the mean, but you're more likely to survive. So there are, sort of difficulties. So what we get with our own colleagues who are not evidence-based aware, what we get with politicians who are not really interested in evidence unless it supports what they say, certainly in my country, and what happens with the general public who don't understand evidence, is we get this tension between the head and the heart. You know, people kind of, you can present people with the evidence, but their heart tells them something else. And I keep hearing people saying, well, I used some complementary therapy, which seems like nonsense to me, and they say, well, it worked for me, you know, so N equals 1. It's a very powerful thing, and no amount of evidence will convince people. That's the problem. Evidence doesn't convince people on its own. Alan made that point this morning, and Hu Yan made that point as well. I don't know what we need. I'm not involved in that movement, but I just know that we need a great deal more. If evidence convinced people, then we wouldn't have, you know, most people couldn't care less. If evidence really convinced people about efficacy of treatments, we wouldn't have things like chiropractic and spine manipulation and things like that, because there is no evidence that these therapies work. All the meta-analysis show that these sort of therapies don't work. We wouldn't be using things like moxibustion because, again, you know, as wedded as people are, certainly in this part of the world, to some of these therapies, all the evidence, I'm afraid, well, the evidence isn't there. I'm afraid they have been tested, and the meta-analysis just show that they don't work, or are sometimes worse than leaving things alone. And, you know, we wouldn't have therapies like Reiki, which can't possibly work because there's no contact. I know I'm being very controversial, but the general public is very wedded to these things, and they use them, you know. And in Hong Kong, people run about with face masks during SARS and during any cold or whatever, during any infectious period, because the Hong Kong Health Authority tells them to wear face masks. But what's the evidence that face masks are effective in stopping cross-infection? Absolutely none at all, because people take them off for a start. You breathe, all you're doing is breathing on two people instead of one. When they strike through, they're worse than nothing. But yet, you know, people make, certainly in Hong Kong, people make millions of pounds out of selling these things. And I've seen people in Shanghai this morning when I went out running wearing face masks. Anyway, all I'm saying is, I'm not saying these people are stupid, I'm just saying that there's no evidence to support these things, yet people do them. So it's an uphill struggle to try and convince people of the need for evidence. Oh, there's the slide, regression towards the mean. I've already spoken about that. Whatever your line of effect is, you'll get effects around it. It's my fault for putting it in the wrong place. So I wanted to change tack slightly. I mean, we can find the evidence quite easily in various places, evidence synthesis databases like the Cochrane Collaboration. We've already seen that this morning. Joanna Briggs Institute, obviously one prime source of information. The York Centre for Reviews and Dissemination. All these different setups, all these different organisations use slightly different methodologies to generate evidence, but they're all very good. The Cochrane Collaboration is very fixed on particular methodologies, not just the methodologies for providing the evidence, but for the ways of doing the reviews. I have no idea what the Joanna Briggs criteria are, because I'm not signed up. I haven't paid to see it, so I don't know, and I don't know what the reports say, because they're only available if you're a member. But the Centre for Reviews and Dissemination at York also has a fairly flexible approach to evidence as well. Right, and we've got in our own country, in the UK, we've got the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, or for Health and Clinical Excellence, NICE. Although those of you who are not from the UK should be aware that NICE is not just about evidence base; it's about health, it's about health economics and cost effectiveness, and it's also subject to a lot of political pressure. A NICE review showed Donezepil for mild dementia didn't work, and two, that even the small effect was very uncost effective, and it really wasn't worth prescribing to people with dementia. However, public pressure and pressure from charities like the Alzheimer's Society on politicians got NICE to change their mind, and it is actually prescribed now. So it shows you, even when the evidence is there, the public put pressure on, and we have to spend money administering a drug which has got no effect. So I'm just saying that evidence is not a neutral thing. Okay, you got the evidence, some people won't listen to it, other people will manipulate it, like it was in the case of the NICE and Donezepil. So that's a sort of run through of one or two background things. What I wanted to spend a few minutes on was this excellent paper. And I realise I've given you the details of the journal, New England Journal of Medicine, a paper by Jeffrey Drazen and colleagues, some famous names up there. And it was published in August. I'm sorry I haven't given you the full reference, but I don't have much time to go into this in detail, but I would really urge people to read this paper. I came across it after I was asked to give this talk, and while I was writing this talk, I thought, that's exactly what I want to get across here. And the paper is about the going beyond randomized controlled trials. Now, as I say, nothing new here for us in this room. I think the nursing profession, Joanna Briggs and other organisations within nursing looking at evidence-based practice have long been aware of this, but the medical profession have finally caught up with us. And it's got several headings within the article, and the conclusion that the article, I'll give the conclusion first, the conclusion that the article comes to is that medicine has got, there's a lot of dark matter, a lot of areas of medicine where we don't have evidence from randomized controlled trials, but we've really got to try and find the evidence. We can't just throw our hands up and say, you know, we've no evidence, so we can't make any decisions. There is evidence out there, and it's maybe not RCT evidence, but it's still evidence that we can use. And what I really like about this article is it not only speaks about it theoretically, it gives four, I think it's, I've had to write them down because I've got to check this to make sure I get the facts correct. It gives four concrete examples of where RCT evidence has not been sufficient or has been wrong. And so for a start, they say that RCT evidence is often lacking. You know, we need to look beyond that for other evidence. Just what I said there. We can't rely on necessarily on the way we've done things in the past. So we need to look beyond that, and we need to look at other outcomes, other data. Do the data exist? Can we assimilate them into practice, whether it's an RCT or otherwise? I'm sorry, the slide's gone a little bit. The formatting's gone a little bit off there. So the examples that they give are four very different ones, exemplifying different aspects of using different evidence. And they give a nice table where you can look at RCTs, meta-analysis. They give examples on the right-hand side, prospective cohorts, case control studies, cross-sectional, ecological, pragmatic trials, and even down to registries and case reports and such like. And they give specific examples on the right-hand side of where good evidence is available from these studies, but not necessarily available from randomized controlled trials. So the first specific example that they discuss in some detail is the use of the live attenuated flu vaccine, which is taken by a nasal spray for flu, for preventing flu epidemics. And the point that they made with this paper was that the RCTs showed very good effect in the short term at preventing flu. However, large-scale population-level follow-up studies showed there was no effect. Flu levels weren't going down. And in fact, the evidence from the RCT, they don't know why, they don't understand what this effect was, but the evidence from the randomized controlled trials, in fact, wasn't correct. It wasn't having an effect. So it's actually been, in certain parts of the world, certainly in the USA, this has been withdrawn now. So we can be misled by RCTs. As I say, they don't know the reason. They say more investigation is needed to find out what went wrong or why that evidence was showing what appeared to be the wrong thing. Then they give the example of treating tuberculosis using streptomycin, and the evidence here from randomized controlled trials was excellent initially, but very quickly when they looked at people after they'd had streptomycin was that they were now then resistant, and resistance was spreading. So they decided they had to look at other ways of using streptomycin, and they underwent a lengthy program of alternating different kinds of treatments and looking at the effect, but not using randomized controlled trials on a large scale, because it would have been impractical and it would have been unethical, because it would have exposed people to potential resistance to streptomycin. So RCTs aren't always possible and they aren't always ethical, but we must look for other ways of finding out what's actually going on, and that's a really good example of that. And now there are regimes whereby antibiotic treatment for TB can be used safely under very controlled conditions and under specific observed ways of giving it. So anyway, just another example of where RCTs were not adequate or possible. Then the effect of sodium intake for reducing blood pressure. Again, randomized controlled trials here showed a very good effect in the short term, but in fact the outcome measure that's been shown since was the wrong measure. They should have been doing repeated measures rather than one-off measures, and some doubt was cast in follow-ups as to whether blood pressure was actually reducing due to sodium intake. So I think something like a 5-year follow-up study was carried out, the details are in the paper, and they found in fact that sodium does help in the long term, sodium reduction does help to reduce blood pressure. So the RCT was right, but it was right for the wrong reasons. You know, so again, we have to be very careful. And I think that's it's quite a complicated example. Even I find it quite, that's why I've got to make sure I've got bullet points here, because I can't remember the details at my great age off the top of my head. Two more things. Again, rare diseases, some rare genetic diseases, and other things that don't happen very often because they may only happen very quickly in certain parts of the world. SARS is a perfect example. Randomized controlled trials are completely impossible here. We've got to find other ways of investigating them. They give some examples, but they don't specify one particular best way of doing it. But again, what they're trying to say is we can't just say we can't do a randomized control trial, therefore there's no evidence. We've got to find rigorous evidence in the best possible way that we can. And finally, this is something that you will be well aware of, economic evaluation, which at one time would probably have been done using randomized controlled trials. People are asked to build in economic evaluations these days into randomized controlled trials, but they're completely inappropriate for economic evaluation because they're not ecologically valid. They're not real world situations. So for economic evaluation, we have to use other designs and the pragmatic trial, whereby you just look, accept what's happening and study that in the long term, is the appropriate, one of the appropriate ways to do this. But I know that people in this room will be well aware of pragmatic trials. So the relevance to nursing is maybe seems a little bit distant, apart from pragmatic trials, which I think are ideal for investigating some aspects of nursing. But I think that these days, and I don't want to preempt what Sana is going to say, but with informatics and big data analysis and things like that, we can get our hands on the data. We can look for different forms of data, and we can make it rigorous. So the possibilities are there to provide alternative evidence, not necessarily from randomized controlled trials. I'm preaching to the converted in this room because I know we've been ahead of this for a long time. So just to finish off, I wanted to, coming back as an editor, I wanted to preach a little bit as an editor, just a couple of slides before I finish. I think that it's very important from our point of view as editors of international peer-reviewed journals to make sure that the evidence that we get in the journals is as good as it possibly can be. And I'm saying this because we still receive manuscripts from I don't mean from China. We do get some from China. We get them from the UK. We get them from all over the world, which don't follow international guidelines. And I'm afraid if papers don't follow international guidelines, they just cannot be assimilated into databases. We don't publish them. And one set of guidelines is the Equator Network, which I won't go into detail, but it tells you how to present randomized controlled trials, how to present qualitative studies, systematic reviews, case control studies. So I think people have really got to, if you do nothing else today, check on the Equator website, and the next time you do one of those studies, make sure you use that. Otherwise, your paper will never contribute towards the database, and that's a waste. Do make sure if you are doing trial work of any kind, and again, this is a real problem these days, do make sure that if you're doing trial work or experimental work, that you do register with an appropriate database under the All Trials campaign. This is an international campaign. I know it's reached China as well. And so I do make sure that you do, because again, if you don't, your evidence will not be assimilated into any systematic review. Also, we are very keen that people register other kinds of designs, quasi-experiments and even surveys. There's no let or hindrance. And I think for the future, we will be expecting, as a publishing industry, and I'm sure once Ben Goldacre, the man there, is happy that All Trials has worked, I'm sure that it will spread out to other methodologies. And I think we should be registering in advance our designs and our methodologies and our protocols in advance for anything that we do these days. So that's one thing, and there are plenty of places that you can register them, the clinicaltrials.gov in the USA, anybody can use that, but there is a Chinese trials registration site which you can also use. I must give a Chinese anecdote. Someone submitted a paper recently to my journal. I said it must be registered with a database. They said there's no requirement in China and we don't have a database. So I said, yes, you do. Here's the link. So they had to do it. So do register your trials. And finally, do make sure that your work falls within all the ethical guidelines. Again, if you look at the Equator website and you also have a look at the COPE website and look at things like duplication, plagiarism, salami slicing, all these different things that people do wrong with studies, and we do have problems with this, authorship studies as well, do make sure that you are aware of these guidelines and follow them. because papers end up being retracted and then they disappear and they can't be included. So if you do a perfect study but you do something unethical in presenting it, or you exaggerate, or you get something wrong, it will not be looked at favourably in terms of publication, and it will not be looked at favourably in terms of being assimilated into systematic review. So those are just from some final points from an editor to try and help individuals, quite simple points, to help individuals to provide us with papers that we can publish and that our colleagues can have confidence in. If you want to annoy me afterwards, that's my email address, so you can email me, and I'm very happy as Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing to look at abstracts for papers in advance. Don't worry, I won't be inundated. I only ever get one or two coming through, but I'm very happy to look at abstracts in advance, because then I can advise you whether they are likely to go forward or not. And that's my ORCID sign. You can check on my publications and on my research grants. And if you want to use a VPN, you can follow me on Twitter, but you shouldn't do that, okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can you please stay in your space for a while? Let me get to mine. Thank you. 其实如果把证据看作一个产品的话呢，其实它经过好几个步骤，从证据的一个产生到证据的一个发表传播，再到证据的应用，所以这个过程当中呢，有三重角色，我们每一个人都有可能成为其中的一种角色，比如作为研究者就有证据的生产者这个角色，那作为编辑就是证据的一个发表的传播者，那临床护士的应用就是证据的一个应用者。 所以这三层角色每一位都要发挥责任担当，要有高度的使命感，保证这个环节当中的每一个就是这个角色要有高质量。那刚才呢，Watson教授呢，他主要是从他的第二重角色，他是一位编辑，所以在这层角色当中，他给我们展示了科学的一个对待证据的一个审慎精神和这样的一个质疑的态度。 你看他首先大胆提问，说那么多的证据发表了，那么多的循证护理文章发表了，但是有没有证据来证明循证护理啊？这是他刚开始的一个大胆的一个发问。接着呢，他对证据进行了一个定义，是一个基于一个系统参与的临床结局。其实这个概念和今天早上的很多知识对应。 是一个循证的终点是要改变临床，是要进行一个临床决策。那么这种临床决策要放到今天早上我们尤琼红艳老师给我们讲到的 我们的实施科学，也就是一定要考虑到一个在系统怀抱当中这个证据如何的应用啊，所以它是一个翻译成系统。 系统参与的临床结局，或者系统参与的临床结局，我们可以探讨。但是呢，这样的一个证据的一个定义啊，它拓展了。第三个呢，它特别提到了一个作为编辑就是提高科学研究的一个透明度。这一点呢，是我们中国科研者发表论文下一步要过去的坎，一定要赶紧跟进了，也就是临床注册的一个跟进。这个注册首先是一个方案的注册，然后呢，自你收集。 临床第一例病例开始，你的数据就要进行注册。如果没有这个，未来发表 SCI 论文非常之难。第四点呢，他又进一步就是强调了科研的一个诚信、道德诚信。所以这几点呢，都是他作为刚才说的第二重角色，也就是证据的传播者他的责任担当。所以证据就在那，不多也不少，不言也不语。但如何让他发挥力量？ 咱们生产者和我们的这个使用者一定要加强我们的使命感，让证据呢成为好证据，带来好的临床改变。那我们再一次热烈的掌声，感谢Watson教授的精彩演讲。
Thank you. That was much better than my presentation.